Welcome, everybody. Good Life Housing Partners, episode 143. Today is Monday, March 18th, 2024. I'm sitting in the DTLA podcast studio with Mr. David Fong. He's got a lot of thoughts on TikTok and the Chinese banning or unbanning of allowing the TikTok to be used in the software to be used and all the Chinese policy around that. And if you haven't heard these opinions before, I'll welcome today one David Fong to the scene as a technologist. Mr. Fong, where does this find you today? TikToking.
Well, it's a Monday right before, I guess, the start of March Madness.
Which
I will be heading to Las Vegas to attend.
And
on to Dallas for a real estate conference.
But, yes.
TikTok, I was just thinking, is interesting because I guess there was a phrase I came across that made me think about it. It's called zombies. It's typically a word used to actually describe in the venture culture world today, a lot of these companies that were once,
promising,
but now it looks like over time they're just hobbling along and they're probably unlikely to return all the money that they've been paid. There's a number of companies like that. And so they're called zombies in the VC world. And a new phrase has come up now called Chinese zombies, because they're like Chinese companies who are kind of stuck in like a weird geopolitical situation. And the classic example is TikTok.
Yes.
And Congress, or at least the House, just passed basically legislation saying that, TikTok's owned by a Chinese company, and given its ties to the Chinese government, they don't like it, no bueno, and they want TikTok to be sold. And they're going to force it to sell if they want to operate in the U.S. Otherwise, they can't operate in the U.S. They're going to ban it. And so waiting for the Senate to sign it. But there seems to be bipartisan support for this. And so
there's full support.
Full support.
So I think it was a complete, like, it wasn't one person that voted against it.
The Chinese government actually has come out with a statement complaining about Congress's actions and saying that, you know, it's very anti-free market.
What did you find about that?
Competition, all this, which is interesting, because when you flip it around, you look at what China does on the inside. You know, China bans Facebook and Google,
and they create YouTube their own.
And they basically protect their domestic industry. So when Western companies are trying to get to China, they're struggling. And so, ironically, now, you know, they don't want to be held to the same rules. And the bottom line is, you know, there are a lot of companies that VCs have also invested in. I think there's $8 billion of Chinese companies like Ant Financial, which is related to Jack Ma's company, and then all these other companies. They're going to be in the crosshairs too of Congress and other people. So the question is, you know, what is the Chinese government going to do? Like, do they either allow, you know, basically it to work both ways, or continue to, you know, or basically then they're just limiting the future of their own homegrown companies when they try to become global. They won't have access to the Western markets.
Yes. So, that's a lot.
And the main reason, however, people think,
please go on. You know, please go on. No, explain this.
You talked about algorithms, and the one thing that's interesting is most likely China won't allow a sale of TikTok, because, you know, if they do, China's very protective over technology, and that software and algorithm that TikTok's got, all that information they got about Americans, because, you know, I forgot what's the number here. Let me see if I can find it.
No, look for it.
How many Americans are addicted to TikTok? and so they, you know, that's the most value of the company. And so, if the Chinese government won't allow that algorithm or software to be sold with the company, then what are you really buying then? I mean, it's the name.
TikTok.
Yeah, but I don't know if it's worth the $20 billion or $30 billion that they say the company's worth for that price. So you're gonna sell it for like a big lot, you know, not much of a profit. And so the analogy they use is like it's like selling Hulu but no content.
Yes.
You just get the name Hulu. Is Hulu really that great a name?
Well, all that is fascinating. I assume it's not going to end well for China, because I think they need the U.S. consumer.
Yeah.
And they don't want to try selling an empty Hulu or whatever else they want to call that. And I think
the other guy that'll be hurt too is U.S. investors too, because a lot of U.S. investors, like I said, have invested into these Chinese zombies.
Yes.
And other companies. And those investors are like pensions.
Yeah.
And university endowments. And so that
they've invested into the Chinese companies?
Chinese companies,
yes. On their tech funds.
Yeah. And so there's estimated about, you know, $146 billion invested by U.S. public pensions and university endowments in
China. Well, they're just not going to disappear either.
So, well, no, but definitely the profit they could, you know, given how successful TikTok was on its trajectory, it's not going to be worth as much money. So there'll be, you know, some losses there. And so, you know, there could be an adverse impact on U.S. investors too. But right now, politically, it's, you know, like you said, I think it was probably pretty, you know, bipartisan.
I don't think anyone's back down. I haven't heard of a non in favor vote.
Yes. So maybe China will adhere to what they say, that how they're a big supporter of free trade.
If you want to zoom out a little bit and actually say something interesting, then one of the things that started to happen now in the last year or two is that there's been a complete stop in the public markets, right? So because of the stock market and
IPOs
have just stopped, right? And so one of the things that people have started saying more and more is that, like, a lot of times that people investing in companies like TikTok on the grand stage, but even much smaller companies like Reddit's about to go public in the next coming month or so, in the coming weeks, really. And like, even if you got into Reddit super early, let's just say 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, which is really early, Reddit was just a basic forum, that your money may be just like double today. And if you just invested in like NASDAQ, your money would be like time and a half, and it's super liquid. So you're not hedged on, like, you know, what the public markets are going to do to the stock. And so there's this growing sentiment that, like, all this technology investing and all this, like, you know, investing to beat the markets to get outsized returns, for the most part, is just like affinity, or like almost like it's investing for kind of fun. It's not really like, because like, you need a few of those to really outweigh all the losses you're going to take.
Yeah,
I mean, you just imagine, like, let's just say you put $1 million in good old Reddit, like, and now it's going public. If you thought that in 2015, you'd expect by 24, almost 10 years later, that that's a 10x. And if you barely doubled, that doesn't feel like right.
Yeah.
That's a lot of risk for, I mean, it's a zero or nothing. And you're just ending up with a double.
Yeah, then you're just better off with, like you said, just more conservative.
Just do NASDAQ or just buy fucking U.S. apartments. Like, I mean, like, you know, there's a lot of basic things you can do to double in 10 years. Like, that doesn't take a lot of, like, ingenuity. So, I don't know. I think there's this growing sentiment, and things like this are starting to really take shape, that people are saying, well, what's kind of the point? Like, well, why am I taking all this risk if, like, I'm not getting, like, you know, not just outsized returns, but mega-sized returns?
Well, I guess it's just like, you know, then you got to turn to crypto.
Because, I mean, again, like, unless you really believe in these things, but these are more affinity type investments, right? Unless you have some sort of inner like belief, or you have some insight or ingenuity, like, as to why that's going to go, like, really soar, what's the point? Like, what have you achieved by doing those things? What's next?
I think we touched on this last time in last week's podcast. You know, a bunch of inflation reports came in, and
lots
CPI,
of inflation.
PPI, all these core PPI, all these, you know, PPI, which is producer price index, and core, yes, PPI is the PPI, but excluding food and energy. Yes. And then the CPI is the general consumer price index. Everything came, bottom line, everything came in higher than expected.
Yes, as expected, right?
As expected. So, so not looking, you know, this higher for longer is still
looming out there for the most part, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, yet that has not shook as yet.
Yeah, yeah. The only thing which I found amusing was Powell actually was in front of Congress last week, and some of these politicians, being politicians, although I enjoyed it, they took him to task on the old 2% inflation goal.
Oh, yes.
And they kept hammering him at him and basically saying, you know, so if your goal was actually 3%,
what are we doing?
You'd be already cutting right now.
Yeah, what are we doing?
And he said he would, but he just said that the 2% is critical to our economy. And you know, the Fed is nowhere near ever changing that as our target. So that's he just stamped his foot down and,
yeah,
and drew the line. So we're not changing it. It's 2%. It's going to stay 2% forever. It's
yeah,
2%. So, so since we're still hovering around 3,
yeah,
like I think we talked about last time, you know, we were at 9 at one point. Going from 9 to 3 is doable, very doable. But this last little 1%,
yeah,
is where we're going to be kind of still floundering around for a while. Another guy joined, Jamie Dimon, who we talked about, who said, you know, oh, maybe the, unlike the rest of the market, who wants these rate cuts. Ken Griffin from Citadel also drew in his name too and said, yeah, you know, maybe the Fed shouldn't lower rates too quickly and thinks maybe we should hold off again. Let's really make sure that inflation is under control. Again, he's worried it'd be a catastrophe if, you know, global catastrophe in our economy if the the Fed, you know, decided to cut and then a couple months later said, oh, you know what, maybe we cut too early. And so he'd rather they just wait it out until they're really, really comfortable to cutting. So, you know, get the higher for longer. Yeah. So Jamie Dimon said it, now Ken Griffin is
well, I think there's this like smaller, very minority side of the of like these talking heads in the economy that are starting to like almost say like you should actually raise. And like,
you think they're actually going the other way?
No, I think people are talking about it. And I think people, I don't know if people are talking about it for a headline grabbing sake or if they're just talking about it like just to be counterintuitive. But there is this sort of like starting to be this reasoning that like you can't really, the way you're measuring inflation is not actually how you should measure inflation, because the inflation now is like seeped into a lot more parts of the economy. And like the actual consumer is actually feeling it much more than what like your data is showing, because it's more than just gas and home pricing. Like the home pricing is slowed way down already. So yeah, even if you go down a quarter basis points, I'm going to suddenly ramp up.
Yeah,
it might ramp the commercial real estate sector up, but it's not going to start the home market up because there's just a lack of inventory. But what they're starting to say is that like more and more people are starting to believe that like there is, it's seeped in all these other places. And that actually another raise might be helpful in further tampering it down and also probably actually really resulting in some real unemployment loss, which will then generate a need to then lower it.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if all that's true. And it seems like a little like contrarian at least. But people are starting to like say, why don't we just like, there is like 1 out of every 10 that's starting to say, well, let's think about, why don't we just raise it?
Yeah. Well, the one thing someone did a comparison to was during the great financial crisis. They were saying, you know, a lot of lenders did the whole extend and pretend, and they're kind of trying to do it now, but they said that, but it's much more challenging now because back then when we did have the Lehman's collapse and all the other things happen, you know, because so many mortgages and mortgage pools were in trouble, you know, the Fed was able to cut basically.
Yeah.
To really get the
economy going.
Bring us back from that
right bank.
Here it's a little trickier because we're not really on the, like, it's not like
we're not on the break.
No.
So and you don't have all these problems.
Yeah. So, but however, as a, you know, they did that and that helped lenders also kind of see, you know, because you know rates are going to go down in the future, it allowed, you know, buyers to come in and see, like, okay, or you know, or at least sellers to hold on. Okay, I'll put more money in because I'll hold on because I can refinance this out with cheaper debt later on. And so in today's, so allow lenders to kind of hold on a little longer. But here, because it's so unsure, and the lenders actually don't have as much reserve set aside. So it's a little bit more challenging time. And the other example, you know, you talked about offline about TREP. There was a multifamily portfolio in San Francisco, my favorite town, that Veritas, I don't know the right way, and affiliates of Valpo's, they had about 1,700 rent-controlled units in San Francisco. And they basically put their loan into special servicing. It was about $674 million loan. And so, yeah, one of the things that the special servicer did that was a little unusual was he actually took a holdback. You know, they sold the property, doing some stuff to it, wrote it down, but then they set aside $164 million that normally people would have expected gone to the bondholders. And they held it back for other costs and things. And so people were surprised because people thought that, you know, certain classes that wouldn't be subject to losses now got hit some losses.
Now being taken losses.
So they're starting to realize like, oh, shoot, there What's may be some on? Real losses in some if more of these services start doing these pullbacks and things, especially if this was a multifamily portfolio, but if it was an office portfolio and some of these other things, like there may be some real hits to some of these CMBS investors that they hadn't really counted on.
Yeah. So. And I think that's real exposure. I think you have real exposure that, you know, that's one of the things that lenders are also, as they, you know, resize loans or re-extend loans or all this stuff, they actually are looking for a lot of this, you know, I guess, I don't think it's a blind spot, but they're looking for like this exposure that they're not accustomed to looking for. And yes, that's another thing that's beyond interest rates and the lack of, you know, clarity going forward. I think that's another thing that has really made things difficult. Here's a fun one. Okay, okay. I got a good number for you.
Okay.
In the history of Dodger Stadium, okay, the history of Dodger Stadium goes back how many years? Executive producer, Mr. Jason, check that for me. Okay, just so he'll come up with that number. How many rainouts do you think there have been?
What do you mean? You mean that the game has been rained out?
Yes.
At Dodger Stadium?
At Dodger Stadium.
Over how many years?
It's at least 60 years.
60 years.
Let's just take 60. I think it's more, but let's just take 60. Because they came here in the 70s, I think.
I don't know. 100 games?
While Jason digs out that number, there's been a total of 18 rainouts.
In its lifetime.
In its lifetime of Dodger Stadium. What's the number? Go ahead, shout it out.
Opened in
1962. Okay, so we're 60 years. Yeah, right? No, 70 years. 70
years, yeah.
72 years. So in 72 years, you've had 18 rainouts.
Oh, that is amazing.
That's a freaking ridiculously low number. Like once every 4 years, that place is raining out.
So every season, not even.
Yeah, once every 4 years, you have a rainout. Once every, like, roughly 300-odd home games. But, and they've been in the playoffs a lot, so.
Yeah, I would think there's.
I would think it's, like, at least once every 2 years. I mean, it's not that dry here, but that just shows you how dry of a climate we live in. Not that I have any clue what it is in other cities, but I got to imagine. Like, I routinely see, like, Cleveland or Boston, Minnesota, these places having, like, a rainout, the players watching the tarp and all that. You know, just an already slow sport get more slow and boring. But it's remarkable. I thought that number was remarkable. So 18 rainouts in 62 years of the history of Dodger, 72 years of Dodger Stadium.
Wow, that's amazing.
I'll take that as my number.
Okay. I'll draw out $418 million.
Okay.
Which is the amount of money that the National Association of Realtors agreed to settle.
Ah, yes. The big lawsuit
where they lost like a billion lawsuit in October.
Yes. Which is not bad.
Yeah,
40 cents on the dollar.
And so they're basically getting rid of all these rules and procedures that people have argued that basically force people to accept.
To use all this stuff.
Which is something I've always thought was the norm, the 6% brokerage commission split between buyers and sellers, agents. And apparently it's you know, the rest of the world was anywhere between 1% to 3%.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize, like, you know, that's actually a lot. That's like double, basically.
Oh, yeah, triple.
Wow, we've been paying that.
Double or triple, or 4x.
And I never questioned it when I bought my house, or you know, and other house deals. And
well, I bet you, you know what's so funny? I would bet you in today, you would question if you were actually going to do something today. Like if you were looking at, let's just say, one of our cities, and you were like, "Let me buy something." Because I know when I was buying a house, I actually resisted hiring anybody because I was like, "I'll just have my attorney do the paperwork. I know how to walk through this. I've done this 100 times. I know how to do it. And unless somebody shows me that they have like additional like listings or something that I can't figure out, like you have no value to me.
Wait, you're talking about on the sales side or
on the buy side? Because I have tons of guys that were like, let me represent you.
How did you find that?
So the guy that I actually took, who's a very cool guy, and he was a good guy. He actually was very upfront. He's like, listen, man. If you want, whatever you want to buy, why don't you mark those areas in Zillow or whatever, and you're going to see it faster than I can see it, then I can send it to you, because I can see you're on top of this. So you're going to see it faster than I'm going to see it, or I can send it to you. And if you see something you like, just let me know, and I'll set it all up. But he was like, you know, I can send you all this stuff, but realistically, you seem like you know you're on top of this, and you're going to probably get to it faster than I can. Because right up front. And the only reason I hired him is because he was working with these, like, spec luxury home flippers, and he was getting some deal flow from them, and a couple of houses I liked, and he's like, I will hand you these if it works out. If you think it'll work out for you, I will get you the deal.
Yeah, see, I've always thought that you can't circumvent these guys. Like, otherwise, you won't find them. I mean, yeah, you walk around and see some signs, but a sale by owner.
No,
but how else do you refund? You really use the MLS, right? And
no.
I'm just saying most of the time people.
Well, you bought your home.
And the only time you get MLS access is if you have the brokers have it. The brokers are all, like, I realize now they've rigged the system.
Well, they've rigged the system. But see, what's funny is, like, you're a very astute real estate guy now.
Yeah.
And, like, and you're all the real estate attorney. And, like, even to you, there was this veil that was fake that was put on there.
Yes.
But it's totally fake. But I would, first of all, the last time you bought a home was probably, like, there was a right now at Dodger Stadium. And then secondarily, I'm telling you, if you went and walked in the system today, even before this, you would have a serious thought of, like, why am I doing this? Especially as you get into higher price tags. I think in the $500,000, you'd be like, whatever. Like, I just need this guy to kind of help me through the transaction. But eventually, if you get, especially up the road, you'd say, maybe I should just cut a better deal and save 50 grand.
Because what's interesting is, like, in New York City, the one thing I did find unusual here, buying something here versus buying in New York City, was in New York City, like you said, I did use the lawyers, also be a lawyer myself. And so,
But
when you came here, there was no lawyer.
Yes.
I was like,
yes.
This is odd. Like, why did we do that?
Yes.
I just thought it was just part of the way it is. So I never dug deeper into why are there really these
different. Right. But in New York is even more complicated because there is this weird system that these folks have put in there, even on the rental side.
Yeah. Well, even
where you've got to be represented.
On the rental side, exactly. When I had to rent apartments, I used to go to brokers.
Yes.
And then similarly, you know, sometimes there was this weird in New York where you didn't really have a broker, but the lawyer was kind of the broker too. He got a piece of the fee. And so it was just, I always thought it was just unusual how we have these different systems in the U.S. and different states. But now I realize that it's all rigged. It's all rigged.
Well, different
than.
Well, let me ask you this. Like,
market, I guess.
I'm guessing, and I keep saying this, because I think if you were to go buy like a $1 million place, I don't know. I think it's 50-50 whether it makes any sense for you to use a broker. But I'm not sure if you would actually even entertain using the broker.
I don't know. Part of it, I would think, maybe in the sense of if it saves me time. I don't want to, if I didn't want to spend the time, like, really.
I think you would use the broker. Here's what I think. I think you would use the broker, and I'm using my own sensibilities, if you were actually moving to another city and you needed actual help in neighborhood and streets and things of that area. That's probably worth it to me. Somebody can, like, you know, understands, we can sort of
sort through this very quickly.
Intangibles that would, that's going to take more. But I think in LA, if you were like, okay, I'm going to buy this house, then I think it starts to get really choppy. Because then it's like, do I really need this guy? He's like literally
I agree. Especially now that I've been here 20 years.
Yeah.
I know the neighborhood.
I want these things.
If I settled like, okay, I want this neighborhood, I probably could drive around and walk around.
Or no, you wouldn't even do that. I mean, you would probably have some younger folk get you all LinkedIn to like Zillow, and then they would just come to your...
Yeah, but isn't this stuff on Zillow? Because I've looked at Zillow before. Like,
don't you
have to go through the brokers on Zillow too?
No.
I thought the stuff that's all there, like, it says on the thing, like, if you're interested in this house, call the.
Yes, guy. And then they also have just the broker listed there.
Yeah, so, but you have to call the broker.
No.
They
have the broker who's listed the property, and then they have the Zillow broker. Have the Redfin guy.
So but you'd still have to call the listing broker.
Yeah, but the listing guy's whatever. That's the seller's going to pay for all that, right? The seller's paying your side too. But if you were saying to the sellers,
I'm not bringing in.
I'm not bringing out. You can 3%. Keep your whole 4 or 3, whatever you manage. Yeah, and you're just like, why don't you cut me down 50-100 grand? That's what I was going to do.
Oh yeah. No, that's
what I was going to do. And I was just going to have my attorney.
That
just
makes
type
sense.
It.
And I agree that. So that will be interesting now to see what's going to happen now. So now, how will the system evolve? In terms of the home buying approach now, and what people, I don't know, what different strategies people, brokers will come up to kind of keep the business flowing. Just to add to that number too, I guess the savings, it's about we pay about $100 billion annually in broker home commissions every year. And they think that'll get cut down to like half.
Yes.
As a result of this decision, which is, you know, savings for
it's
the
legit.
Consumer.
So no, it's legit.
Consumer savings. So
it's not a joke. It's legit.
It really made me realize, like, wow, it really wasn't.
No, it's real. Out.
I mean, I'm sure there's residential brokers very upset about this, but.
Yes. Yes. All right. Let's keep it a little tight because you're traveling and I'm sitting here. But What any upgrades?